Well, welcome one and all to the second week of the Lambeth Conference. From today, we will start to see the beginnings of a sense of direction emerging in the conference, in that we will get our first glimpse, really, of the things that are going to be discussed in the next week in terms of outcomes from the conference. So two important documents will hit the deck today. The first is the third of the contributions from the Windsor Continuation Group. That will be given to the bishops at the 2 o'clock hearings meeting this afternoon, which again, I just underline, sets our deadline. The bishops need to be out of here at 2:55 so we can be there for that. The second document that the bishops have just been given is the very, very, very preliminary first go, and it's really a scoping document and not much more than that at this stage, the first go at the reflections document, which will be the document produced as the outcome of the conference. Now, because of those two things and because we're aware of your interest in them, our proposal is to schedule a second media conference for today at 5 o'clock, and you might have been told about that this morning. We'll have Bishop Clive Hanford, the chair of the Windsor Continuation Group here, and Archbishop Roger Hurft of Perth, who is chairing the Reflections Group. So they'll be here at 5 o'clock to speak to you about those two documents, and the documents will be available to you. You're aware that tonight we have Sir Jonathan Sacks addressing a plenary conference on the biblical idea of covenant. So that's on tonight in the Big Top, and you all have access to that. The theme today, you're aware, is about interfaith dialogue and relationships between churches of the communion and other faiths. And we have with us today two distinguished leaders in that area, Bishop Bishop Tom Butler, the Bishop of Southwark, who's been involved in that area of work for a long time, and the Bishop of Lahore, Bishop Alexander Malik, who's also the moderator of the Church in Pakistan, so the primate of the Church in Pakistan, and they will address us in just a moment. The other gentleman we have with us is Father Richard Carter. Richard has spoken to the spouses this morning, and there's a lot of interest in Richard's story and experience in the Solomon Islands and the story of the martyrs there a few years ago. So Richard is here. Richard will speak at the end, so with your cooperation, we'll deal with the interfaith matters first, and the bishops will get away to the hearings, and Richard is happy to speak for some time and to take a few questions. But I think Richard's got about 10 or 12 minutes or thereabouts at that stage, so hopefully that will give you enough time. So let me introduce then Bishop Tom Butler. I apologise, Tom. And he will speak to us about the document, Generous Love, and also the process around the document, A Common Word, from the Muslim scholars to which the Archbishop of Canterbury has responded. So welcome, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you this afternoon, and it's good to be addressing today this particular subject. And I suppose no subject will have changed so dramatically in the last 10 years since we last met at a Lambeth conference, because then, in a sense, interfaith dialogue for many of us was a kind of theoretical and interesting question. But now it really very much is high on the agenda of virtually every bishop in the world, because we mostly now live in a multi-faith environment, and also because of developments in the world in that time, matters of faith and religion have become high on the agenda of politicians as well as bishops. my own situation, I'm Bishop of Southwark in England, which means that my diocese is half of Greater London. And so very much I'm living cheek by jowl in a multicultural, multi-faith environment. Literally, my next-door neighbours are members of other faiths, and one is always bumping into people of other faiths. One thing that can't be denied when you're living in that situation is that many of these people are extremely good, devout people who are also wonderful citizens. And the first thing I'd be wanting to say in my situation in Britain is that they have been allies in trying to rebuild community through all the tensions that may have pulled it apart in the last decade or so, 9/11, the war with Iraq, etc. And it's because we do know one another rather well as faith leaders that we can play our part in being the glue which holds society together for the common good. And therefore, the first document, Generous Love, which have been sent to all bishops, an Anglican theology of interfaith relations, is very helpful for me in my situation. And from what I've heard this morning, listening to other bishops from very different situations, it's also helpful to them. And it sets out in a systematic way the particular Anglican approach to interfaith relations based on the experience of 20 years or more around the globe. Of course, we build on what has also come out of the Roman Catholic Church, what has come out of the World Council of Churches. But there's a particular Anglican way of doing things, and our way is being there, being a presence in every community of whatever sort. We're there for the long term. We're there to both witness to our faith, but we're also there to work with others for the common good in serving the community. And of course, we're there in a big way in the world of education and in health. And so this spells out in a helpful way, it's kind of a discussion booklet for bishops to take home and discuss it with their people and build upon it. I think for me, a good example of what it's saying, we saw last week in the London Day, and I know many of you were involved in the London Day, and you'll remember that in Lambeth Palace, on the platform, when the Prime Minister was speaking, on that platform was the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he obviously had convened all of that, but there was also the Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster, the senior Roman Catholic, there was the Chief Rabbi, there was Injit Singh, a senior Sikh leader, there was Iqbal Sukrani. All the major faiths and denominations were on that platform. And that, I believe, gave us a much greater authority to speak to the politicians of the world, represented by the Archbishop, on the matters of poverty and the Millennium Goals. And the flip side of that was the Prime Minister, any Prime Minister of Britain, I think is more comfortable when he's actually addressing faith matters to a group of faith leaders rather than any particular denomination. We're stronger in pressing our case, and I believe he is more relaxed in responding. And I think it was a very, very good example of how interfaith work can work for the common good. The other document, the Common Word, is a response from the Archbishop to the letter from 138 Muslim scholars and religious leaders, which were sent to the heads of the Christian churches in October 2007. It came out of the response came out of a conference which the Archbishop convened, but he then has written the response. And it's basically saying, yes, we welcome the initiative of the Muslim scholars, that we have got many things in common, we also have got many differences. And it is right to be clear about the things we have in common and what divides us. And at this time in history, this is a time when we can sit down together and wrestle with all of that in an authentic way without any of us losing our integrity. There hopefully will be a follow-up to that later in the year. So this is part of the process. So there's a lot going on, and we're very happy when my colleague has spoken. We're very happy to field any questions that you may find of interest.
In welcoming Bishop Alexander, it's worth just drawing to your attention that Bishop Malik has been awarded twice, once in 2000 and his second time in 2005, the highest civil award from the Pakistani government precisely for his work in interfaith dialogue. So he's made an outstanding contribution in that nation and beyond. So welcome, Bishop Malik.
Thank you. Archbishop.
You're happy to speak.
I'm sorry. Well, interfaith dialogue is not, is extended to all faiths, not only to Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism. And I would prefer that there should be a dialogue with the secularist West also. And this is the point which I raised today in Daba group also. But I will be speaking mostly in the context of Islam, particularly with our own situation in Pakistan. And before I say more, I want to make four simple statements to put the thing in its perspective, the dialogue. First, that 9/11 both created difficulties and opportunities for dialogue. And I will speak about that later. Second statement I would make, all Muslims are not terrorists, nor all Christians are Westerners. And third, dynamics of interfaith differs when Muslims are in a minority and when they are in majority. In the context or in the perspective of religious extremism, dialogue does become very difficult, but not impossible. But the difficulty is with our misunderstanding of dialogue also. Many Christians feel that dialogue is a betrayal of mission and evangelism, which it is not. Others feel that dialogue is a debate about your positions, which again, it is not a debate. Some people feel that dialogue is a compromise, watering down your own religious commitments and things of that sort. I have been a bishop and am still continuing in service for the last 28 years in Lahore, and I have found that interfaith dialogue is an excellent way of communicating the love of God expressed in Christ. And this, we are doing it, and it helps to build relationships and also connect each other. Because basically we are all humans and we have to respect each other's religious beliefs and all. But dialogue is for us a daily business. It's a dialogue of life. We run into each other in our offices, while traveling on the buses, or we don't have tubes, but trains. So we run into each other and ask each other questions about their faith and all. Dialogue has also helped us to help our people, especially in transforming the society. And we do it through education, through healthcare, through program of poverty alleviation, all irrespective of creed, caste, or color. All these, we do it in the context of Pakistan, and I have found that right, if I can go back from the inception of Pakistan till today, the top leadership in Pakistan in most cases have been through our schools and colleges, students of our Christian missionary institutions. All these help. It is always a very small minority which disturbs the relationship. And if you can excuse me, that sometimes the Western policies generate these misconceptions and clashes. For example, publication of Danish cartoons. In your context, it's the freedom of press, freedom, but the Islamic, the Muslim concept is a little different. And to some extent, Christians in Pakistan also feel this should not have been done. The other is the foreign policies, for example, war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan. Otherwise, I was just reflecting when His Grace Philip asked me to speak, and thinking back that what other incident I could think of when there was a clash between Christians and Muslims, and I could not think except one. But most of these came after the 9/11, when people thought that the West is not doing right, it's not justified for war in Iraq. But dialogue is one which helps us in the rural situation, in the urban situation, where we can try and build the relationship. And in quite a number of cases, we have been very, very successful. Thank you.
Thank you, Bishop. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes for questions. Up the back first, yes.
Yeah. Klaus Nelson from the German Catholic News Agency. Bishop Malik, you were telling about provocations of clashes. What about the mentions of Bishop Michael Nasir Ali on this so-called no-go areas in Britain for Islam people? Did this have any affection to the Christians in Pakistan, those words, which were very controversial?
Well, Bishop Tom might know more about the situation in England, and then you might like to add something.
That's right.
Yes, certainly in England. I have to say it hasn't been my experience. I've been a bishop now for over 20 years, and I've been a bishop always in multicultural areas, Bishop of Leicester, Bishop of Wolston, where there have been strong communities of people of other faiths. I've never felt there have been no-go areas in any of the dioceses where I've served. So it may be the experience in Rochester, but it's not mine.
Bishop Alexander, do you want to add to that?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Reza.
This is a question for the Bishop of the Hall. Salaam alaikum. Riaz Akbar from The Guardian. As a minority living in a Muslim-majority country, what advice would you give to Muslims who are living as a minority in Britain? How do you view their situation, and what advice would you give them on integrating without assimilating, let's say?
Well, I already mentioned and gave a little statement that when Muslims are in a majority, they are not interested in dialogue. It is always the minority which is more interested to have a dialogue, make a space and all of that, more accommodating. My advice to the Muslims here would be to go ahead with dialogue and assimilate the values of the culture which they have opted to adopt.
Thank you.
Stephen Brown, Ecumenical News International, Geneva. Statistics show that in Pakistan there seems to be a disproportionate use of blasphemy laws against Christians, and there have also been a number of other reported incidents in recent months about kidnapping of young girls who were forced to marry and become Muslims, which was upheld by a civil court. And my question to you is, how do you feel Christians in other parts of the world, the church in other parts of the world, should support you as Christians in Pakistan? Do you want them to protest against such incidents, or do you feel that protest against such incidents might make the situation worse for you?
No, as far as the blasphemy is concerned, we are protesting, and the international community is most welcome to protest, because that is like a hanging sword on the minorities.
Thank you.
Where's Gabriel from Italy, Svita Cattolica? You were talking about Bishop Anglican approach in comparison with another Roman Catholic approach. So my question to both is, how was the reaction of the Anglicans after the talk of Benedict XVI in Regensburg that stirred up a lot the reaction of Muslims, especially in Pakistan?
Well, of course, the Muslims were not happy at all. And I was asked to make a comment, but to be truthful, I little sheltered myself. I'm an Anglican bishop, so they should go to the Roman Catholic bishop and ask him. But I did get the true story, what he exactly said and all of that. So on a quieter side, I have been defending him, but not to the media, because to the media, I said, go and talk to the Roman Catholic bishop or papal nuncio.
Thank you, Bishop Tom.
I think you've heard the authentic Anglican response to that.
Thank you, Jane.
Jane Still, Anglican Media, Melbourne. My question is for Bishop Tom. Given the fears expressed by some of the bishops, for example, the Sudanese, about the possible repercussions of decisions that the Anglican Communion makes with regards to repercussions for them from Islamic groups, how does the Anglican Communion go about making sure that it doesn't become increasingly defined by reactions to extremism?
It's reactions to extremism.
Extremism and perceived threats of violence from...
Yes, I don't see that as being a major problem. I think we realise, particularly here in Britain, where we've had the experience of extremism in Northern Ireland over decades, I think we realise that one can't judge whole faith communities on the basis of small numbers of extremists. And so our policy has always been to try to support and build up the influence of what you might call mainstream faith leaders, so that they're better able to tackle extremism in their own faiths, including our own. And so I think that is the way we try to go about our business.
I've spotted three others. We'll see how we go. George, then you, then Chris.
Question for if we've got time.
Question for Bishop Malik, George Ponder, speaking of the Jerusalem Post. You mentioned the war in Iraq and Afghanistan as being detrimental to the minority in Pakistan. How has the situation in Israel and in Palestine impacted the minority Christians of Pakistan?
Yeah, it's the same. Because there again, they feel that the Western countries are not fair. I think that is the mindset throughout the Muslim world.
Thank you. In the second row, yes, sir.
What is the situation on the ground for Christians in Pakistan? We read quite regularly there is persecution. Are you experiencing that?
Well, I already said that majority of the Muslims are very good people. You can live with them, and all there is no. It is always a small minority, whatever you may like to call them. But if I may say, those very people whom Western world is describing terrorists, when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, they were described by the West as the Mujahideen. So West has a part in producing that extremism and terrorism. Generally, we have been living very happily.
Thank you. Chris?
Yes, Malik said that Muslims were not interested in dialogue in situations where they're in majority, and Bishop Butler, in his introductory remarks, suggested that interfaith issues were higher on the agenda because of political concerns and politicians' interests. This tends to give the impression that interfaith issues are determined by the necessities of a political agenda, and it seems to be somewhat asymmetrical and one-sided. What is being done in the Anglican Communion and interfaith dialogue for Christians in countries such as Saudi Arabia to have freedom to worship?
Thank you.
I think Saudi Arabia is an extreme case, as we know. It's extremely difficult for Christians to worship there. I think our faith leaders do all that they can to make representations. I don't think Saudi Arabia is in any way typical of most countries where Islam is in the majority. But I think I also would want to say that I'm just as interested in countries where Muslims and Christians are sharing the common life together. This morning I heard in my Indaba group from the Bishop of Eastern Zambia who said that there they have started a Muslim-Christian HIV-AIDS group in order to tackle HIV and AIDS, which is to be found in both the Christian communities and the Muslim communities. And it has had dramatically the effect of both communities being able to accept openly, yes, this is a problem for us. And having been able to accept it, then it's enabled individual people suffering from the disease to openly go and get the medical treatment that they need. Now, I think that is a very good example of the fruits of interfaith dialogue, and I think it's far more typical than some of the more dramatic stories that we hear.
Thank you. Do you wish to add to that, Bishop?
No, I think that's fine.
Well, we have reached our 5-2 deadline, so if you'll excuse the bishops, I'll call to the lectern, Father Richard Carter, who made a very moving and interesting presentation to the spouses this morning to share something of his story from Melanesia with you. And Paul, you might come forward and just look after the question time following what Richard has to say. Thank you, and we'll see you again at 5:00, those of you who wish to come.
Thank you very much. The spouses this morning had a session in which we looked at the gospel as the gospel of peace, the gospel of peacemaking. And I was asked to come along and tell the story of the community I've been living with for 17 years in Melanesia, called the Melanesian Brothers and the Melanesian Sisters, who are a religious community who are working for peace. Not just a specific story from Melanesia, but really a story which is a parable of peacemaking throughout the world. We often hear of religion involved in causing conflict, but many people look to the church and the Christian faith as the source of reconciliation and peace. In 1999, in Solomon Islands, which was called the Happy Isles, an ethnic tension broke out between two of the island groups. As in many countries, it was focused on land ownership. Many of the people from the neighbouring island of Malaita had moved since the Second World War, where the huge battle between the Japanese and the American forces took place on Guadalcanal, had moved to Guadalcanal and had owned more and more of the land, had become successful in business. Many of the Malaitans had become members of the police force. Many had become very politically active and were seen by the Guadalcanal people to become more successful than they were. At first, the Malaitans had been welcomed to the island of Guadalcanal, but gradually, as things progressed, a greater bitterness was growing under the surface. In 1999, I was working there as a priest. People came to the same church, prayed together, played football together. There was intermarriage between the tribal groups, and we never thought that anything serious would happen. In 1999, we heard of a militant group on the weather coast of Guadalcanal under the leadership of a man called Harold Keke had started that was demanding independence for Guadalcanal and that all the migrant workers went back to their own islands. Again, like in all situations of violence, you never think it's really going to happen to you. At first, it started slowly. Young Malaitan children from the schools were told to get out of the schools and return to Malaita. And then we heard news that villages were being burnt down. Again, the news was often vague and there were a lot of rumours and we didn't believe that it would escalate. But slowly we heard news of torture and we heard news of murder. And in the next 2 or 3 months, 20,000 people became homeless because their villages were burnt down. And our religious community, the Melanesian Brotherhood, which was a group of brothers living a gospel lifestyle, simple gospel lifestyle, of poverty, chastity and obedience. You may have seen them dance last Sunday. They suddenly became a community where thousands of people were arriving on our doorstep seeking protection. And again, this is a story which you see over and over throughout the world. The church is looked to at times of conflict as the safe place, the place which can provide sanctuary and hope for the people. Because again, this is a gospel of peace. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Here we were, a religious community with about 10,000 people looking to us to help them. At first, we provided help by sheltering them, banning any militants from entering where we were living. We refused to let anyone with any guns or any ammunition come onto our station, and trying to ferry them out of where we were living to the capital city by helicopter and by truck. But again, we thought we needed to do more, and eventually 25 of our brothers committed themselves to go and work in the no man's land between the two front lines of the militant groups. They visited the militants each day. They tried to remind them that a better way was possible. They spoke out against torture. They spoke out against this culture of violence, saying that violence would only lead to greater violence. They helped people find relatives that were lost. They ferried back the wounded. They even had to carry dead bodies of people who had been decapitated in the struggle. They witnessed terrible events. But it was this group of peacemakers who, much more than the police or the army, people looked to for help. And also the sisters and the women's groups, the Christian women's groups, came to prominence, providing shelter and providing care for people. In 2000, a peace agreement was signed in Townsville, but like in many situations of conflict, the guns and the ammunition were in young people's hands. The average age of a militant was aged between 15 and 25, and even after the peace agreement was signed, the gangs and the fighting continued. They attacked businesses, they held up people on the road, they continued to carry out vendettas against people who been their enemies in the struggle. And again, as a community, we realized that there would be no peace for the nation while guns and ammunition were still being held by the militants. We held off because gathering weapons, as Northern Ireland knows, is a very political move, and we were uneasy about getting involved in politics. But in 2002, as a whole community, we decided, after praying together, that we needed, there would be no peace for the country unless we took part in the disarmament process. We were a young group. We had no experience of disarmament or any, we'd never done any courses in conflict resolution. But we sat down and we decided how to go about it. We decided that the best way to go about it was to put out a broadcast on the radio, which would be played 10 times a day, in which we offered the militants that if they wanted to renounce their weapons, we would visit them wherever they were. We would pray with them. We would ask for forgiveness for them and their family for actions which had taken place. We would take away their guns. We promised that we would destroy their guns, and we would never, ever disclose the names of the people who gave ammunition or guns to us. Perhaps you'd think it was a fairly naive strategy, but it was the only way we knew how to do. And we put out this broadcast 7 times a day playing. Within a few days, we were being bombarded by calls from all over the island. I was living in a house which we were called the Reconciliation House in Honiara, the capital city. And there was a room in the house. I said, wouldn't it be great if we could fill this room with the weapons we had collected? I said it as a joke. But within weeks, the place was stacked with machine guns, automatic rifles, hand grenades. You wouldn't believe a little country in the middle of the Pacific could have accumulated so many weapons from the Western world. And people wanted to give them back. Why had they come to us to give them back? Again and again, the story was the same. People came because they felt traumatized by what they'd been through. Many of them had blood on their hands and had done things which were truly nightmarish situations, had been involved in situations. And they came to us because they wanted the chance to start again. And they came because they believed that we were Christians and could help them. It wasn't in our power to give them forgiveness. But we do believe in a gospel which is a gospel of forgiveness, where 70 times 7 we are promised forgiveness, where the person we follow promises us forgiveness from the cross. Therefore, we prayed with them. We took away their weapons, and we took all these weapons out to sea. which is called Iron Bottom Sound, and dropped these hundreds of weapons in the presence of the police commissioner into the sea. But people were beginning to say, oh, the brothers are colluding with the government, they're helping the government, favouring one of the militant groups as opposed to another. We kept on doing our work. We didn't talk with the government, we didn't talk with the militant groups, we spoke to everybody. One of the militant groups on the weather coast of Guadalcanal refused to renounce their weapons, and some of our brothers went to visit him, and he took one of our brothers hostage. Six of our brothers went to try and find this brother who had been taken hostage and find out what had happened to him, and there were rumours that he'd been murdered, and we wanted to find out if this was true, and if it wasn't true, to try and negotiate his release. At this stage, no one could trust the police force because they were colluding with one of the militant groups as well and had many illegal arms. We waited for those seven brothers to return. We were told that they were being held hostage too and that they were being accused of being spies. At that time, it was a very key time in the history of the Solomon Islands. Australian government, who'd refused to get involved, heard about this story. It was also the time just after the Bali bombings, when Australia was changing its foreign policy towards its neighbours. They eventually, together with New Zealand and Papua New Guinea and Fiji, decided to send an army of intervention. Personally, I'd always been against armies of intervention. But at this stage in the Solomon Islands history, we needed peace and we needed security. That army arrived and never fired a bullet. They did, however, find that our seven brothers, who had gone in search of peace and had helped to negotiate the peace, had been very badly tortured and then murdered. As a Christian and as the chaplain of the community, it was my job to relay that news to the families, and in common with families who faced homicide in their own lives, it was the worst moment of my life. And yet it was also the moment in which I realised more truly than ever before the values to which I believed in and which our community believed in, and the choice in that country that everybody had to make. On the one side, there were young people being sucked into militant action, into torture and violence. And on the other side, there were a group of brothers and sisters who were prepared to stand up for peace and to live the gospel that they proclaimed, not in a church, but out there face to face with the people who were pulling their country to pieces. At their funeral in November of that year, we managed to get their remains back from the weather coast of Guadalcanal. It stopped the whole nation, a bit like our nation here in UK has been stopped by funerals of those who have been killed in knife crime in London. Somehow those moments are times when people are called to their senses and made to realise that the true choices that they have to make, and that the Christian gospel is not about arguing with one another, it's actually about standing up for the truth we really believe in, the truth of peace, the truth of reconciliation, the truth that actually there can only be unity if there is some degree of forgiveness and an ability to move on. Cultures often become cycles of revenge with people arguing for payback, payback, payback. And unless one breaks that culture of payback, there can be no way forward. The Solomon Islands have learnt that actually the people that need to be empowered in the peacemaking process are the people who are involved in the violence. And the young people, age 15 before 20 to 25, also have the capability of becoming those who make the peace if they are inspired by the gospel we proclaim. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we have time for a few questions, if you have some. Please, Graham.
How old am I? I'm 49. I worked there for 17 years. Why didn't we give up? Because in a situation like that, there's nothing to give up to. There's no alternative. You can't pick up 999 and say, could you come in and help us? There's nowhere to turn to. I think people in this country sometimes don't realise that in situations like that, it is total chaos. And you can't give up, because if you give up, there's no one else to hold on to what you believe in. And I mean, of course, at the times in that community, I thought I'd like to get out of here. But if I got out of there, what about the other people who were still praying each day? They were the ones that people were looking to. They were the only hope to the nation. People used to come to us and say, your community is the only thing that's giving us hope at the moment. So we couldn't give up.
Any others? Okay. Thank you very much. Remind you that the other press conference will begin at 5 o'clock. We will have copies of the third part of the Windsor Continuation Group available for you at 4:45 here in the Missing Link. We'll hand those out about 15 minutes before the press conference starts. Thank you.